They are more than a band. They are an institution. They are the Scatolites, and that's ska reggae high bop. It's from their 1994 album, High Bop Ska. Lester Sterling on alto sax, Zem Audu on tenor sax, Andre Murchison on trombone, Travis Antoine on trumpet, Val Douglas on bass guitar, Natty Frenchy on guitar, Ken Stewart on keyboards, and Trevor Sparrow Thompson on drums. It's a nice little throwback there for you. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Free Your Mind Friday. Why is it good to free your mind? Well, you know better than most. A free mind is a clear mind. And what do we need clear minds these days? Let me start off by reminding you to those of you who are able to make it, and I hope you will be, many of you, on March 11th. That's on Sunday, March 11th. I'm going to be at the Community Church of New York. At about 1:30, we will begin our little talk. And the church is on Park Avenue and 35th Street. So it's very conveniently located. I'm looking forward personally. Talking is one thing, but the seeing is another. This is going to be my first major foray outside of the boundaries of Florida in quite a few years. So I'm looking forward to seeing your wonderful smiling faces, and we have a nice little get together, and I'll say, "Oh, I see your voice, so and so," and you get to see my voice up close and personal. So put it in your calendar. We'll give you more details as we go. But the most important thing is to set aside Sunday, March 11th. And on Sunday, March 11th, all roads lead to the Community Church of New York. I'm going to be there, and we'll be talking and fellowshipping, if you will. All right. So we start our program proper, 888-874-4888, talking about the issues that you haven't been able to talk about just yet. And the floor is all yours. You take the conversation wherever you want it to go. Marie from Baltimore starts us off today. Hello, Marie.
Hello, you, Therese. I got your name right.
Yes, you did.
I hope you are feeling all right. And the way I can remember you is YOU. That'll help me to remember.
Thank you.
I'm going to make this brief. Well, I'll start out saying Monday evening I saw an old film, black and white, of the Black Panthers. And that sort of reminded me of things that happened in the past, and it was a good education. The new Panther movie, which I am not going to see, you have confirmed me after I saw the new, old Black Panthers, what you had to say, whatever day this week, about the new show on the Panthers, it has confirmed me not to go. The new Panther movie, like someone else said, blacks have spending power, but no power. And the film gets you excited, but you pay for it. Now,
Exactly.
the
You pay for it, and it has nothing to do really with the real world. It doesn't. Not that a film has to deal always with the real world, but the fact is, there is a genre of filmmaking. You know, it puts us into the sci-fi world and the world of comics and so forth, and that's fine. But you know, people are so easy to they take what should be a very, very serious subject. At least this is the way I feel. I think many cultures would love seeing movies about themselves, but they are real clear that there's some things that are sacred and you don't mess with them.
Yes, and another thing, too, for 2 hours, I heard the film was that long, you may be happy and excited, but the next day or whatever, you got these budget cuts coming up.
Okay.
Social Security, and you got
Trump into reality, doesn't it?
Yes, and Trump wants to privatize water in connection with Wall Street and other things I can't remember right now. And you played the proper song that day you mentioned about the movie about Gil Scott's Winter in America. That's going to mean winter in my pocketbook, the way things are going around today. But that's all I have to say, and thank you so much.
Thank you for calling in and very capably representing Baltimore. Not that that's your job, but it is a delight to have someone of Baltimore offering the views as you do. Thank you so much for calling in today.
One more thing before hang up. They're going to have a play in Baltimore on two important people, Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. They're having actors in a play this weekend. That should be interesting. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Harvey from Berkeley, you're on the air.
Hi, you, Trees.
Hey, what's up?
Well, as you know, Trump and his administration are backing the oil companies who want to drill and frack for oil and methane off America's coastlines. And because our over-the-top use of fossil fuels is creating severe climate destabilization, it's really time for us to take personal action to save Mother Earth from catastrophic degradation. And in January in New York, Mayor Bill de Blasio declared the city's massive retirement pension fund is divesting $6 billion from the oil, coal, and gas industry, as well as suing five of the biggest oil companies, including Exxon and Chevron, for climate change damages. And it turns out that for decades, Exxon knew everything about climate change, but they didn't do anything because they didn't want to hurt their bottom line, their revenue stream. So it's our chance as individuals to leverage our individual power at the grassroots level by getting in touch with our local city council members and telling them to follow New York's example. And some of the ways we can get in touch with them are attending our city council meetings and speaking about the fossil fuel divestment during public comment segment, emailing our city council members demanding that they follow New York's city's pension portfolio divestment of fossil fuels and reinvestment in clean, renewable energy. We could phone our city council members who represent your district and as well as the mayor and ask for a meeting with them to discuss fossil fuel divestment as well as renewable energy reinvestment. And it's a good time to bring a few like-minded friends and family members to help your position. And we can also write small editorials for the opinion page of local newspapers demanding a change for the better by following New York's example for fossil fuel divestment. So each and every one of us can take a personal stand here and use our power to create a better world for us, our children, and future generations.
Well said. I'm sure you have gotten wind of the plan that was just floated. They say, you know, it was just an idea. But, you know, to put a kind of gas station, a refueling station on the moon for vessels that need it in outer space. I mean, this is the latest bright idea. That tells you this administration, a whole bunch of people are on some very strange psychotic meds, and they're so tone deaf.
I mean, you
wonder what would make anybody. First of all, if it's an idea that occurs to you, fine. But to now proselytize it and to say, "Hey, this is a good idea, folks. This is where we're going." What is it? What kinds of psychotic drugs are these people in the Trump administration taking? Thanks so much for your call today.
Okay,
Peter,
thank you.
From New Jersey. Oh, you're welcome. Peter from New Jersey, you're on the air.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello? Okay, yes. Just recently, I did an Ancestry.com test, and I did an African Ancestry.com test just to find out, you know, the results of my, maybe my African ancestry or whether, you know, whether ancestry. To my amazement, it came up European Jewish, or Ashkenazi, they say. And so when I did a little bit more research, found out this is, like, common among African people.
A couple of things. What did you have to do, what did you have to submit for this test?
You had to give a saliva.
Saliva. And from saliva, they get all your DNA markings and so forth.
Yes, I know. Right. Okay.
Does it sit comfortably with you that essentially you handed over your genetic material to somebody you don't know for purposes you don't know, except that they will tell you where you came from?
Yes, but at the time, I wasn't thinking about that, to be honest with you. I mean, it could, anything can fall in the hands of evil people. Because, yes. I mean, with the information that we all have now, I mean, there's been an explosion of information now in this decade than any time before in history. You know? But to my amazement,
yeah, but,
also...
But it isn't it? And I can understand your curiosity, but number one, these two particular organizations, Ancestry.com and AfricanAncestry.com, they have no convincing credentials about their ability to place you on the basis of your DNA, and heaven knows whether they actually are doing that. They say they're doing that. But my feeling is we ought to be very careful about giving our DNA to anybody, because guess what? You just gave them permission to own your DNA.
Okay. All right.
Be part of a bank, and they are constantly building. People genuinely want to know things, right? And
this
sounded like a great idea. But think for a minute that all these people genuinely wanting to know where they came from voluntarily send their DNA material, their genetic material, to an organization. What you are doing is you are, in effect, giving them the license to do whatever they wish to do with your DNA material, including sharing it with we don't know which agencies, sharing it with agencies that are studying things. People are picking up all kinds of nuances with the genetic material that they have studied. And we don't know what they're going to do with it, but we have a historical record to refer to.
Okay.
We've had the experiments in Tuskegee. We've had many experiments in the United States of people's genetic material being used to further all kinds of things we don't know about.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to be very careful about voluntarily turning over your genetic material. In regular circumstances, for anybody to have access to your genetic material, that should involve a court order. Because, you understand, this is not something that people should have ready access to. But they, again, this is part of the thinking that goes behind this movie that is out, The Black Panther. We are so in need, we so desperately want some kind of information having to do with where we came from, who we are. And as a business model, think about it, as a business model, it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. All these folks just send in their genetic material. We get to keep it. We get to analyze it. We don't even have to prove whether we did a good job of researching.
Right.
We don't know whether they have geneticists and people who are specialists in this area. All we know is that they're collecting hundreds and hundreds of millions of people's DNA.
Right.
Would it have in the future, would it have implications for government programs to find out if you have a particular gene, will you next be targeted for some kind of program because that gene either makes you extra special or extra dangerous to the government? You know, you have to think about these things. Don't volunteer your genetic material for any in any situation where you have no idea, you have no control over what is done with that genetic material. And it may sound very innocent, but we are a new business. It's a fun thing to do. You voluntarily send us your genetic material. We'll send you a result. It may not even be true. It may not even be accurate.
Two positive things that came out of this here was that two other people took that test. If you take the test and with family, it matches us up. So this young girl got in contact with me, and she said she's so happy to meet me because she didn't know any of her biological family. But it matched us up as first or second cousins. So when we finally
You have no countervailing evidence as to whether that is true. You just got a result from unknown faces, unknown people in this company Fred, meet Mary, you guys are cousins.
Yeah, no, but our names are different, so it was no way possible that through a name they could have matched us up. She was in Texas. She used to be here in Jersey. So when it matches up, it says possible first, second cousin. So when I got to talk to her, I said, do you know any of your biological family? She says, no. Only thing I know is that my grandmother's name was Hazel. And then I was able to make a match. I said, you are my
aunt. Still,
you
don't know for sure. This is the point. This is not assured science, clinically proven. We don't know what they're doing, how they're getting things. All we know is that they're building an ever-growing reservoir of information and telling, you know, they put there's a narrative as to, you know, here you are discovering a cousin this late in life. This is fantastic. You feel good about it. So you tend not to have any suspicions about what they're doing with your genetic material. In your mind, they're just hooking up people who didn't know they had ancestors in common. But it is not proven. Their business model is not proven to be accurate. And what is it based on? Right now, for example, let's just say they've established a connection between you and this young lady as related. There may come a time when a government would be interested in eradicating all people with a particular genetic marker. I did a story many years ago called The Violence Initiative. It was based on the work of Dr. Peter Breggin. And he was the one who exposed the fact that without our knowledge, the government was working on identifying what they call violence markers. This would predict which children in the future are likely to be violent. And they collected material and whatnot. Same thing. And they have it now. So that even if they wish 20 years from now to conduct a program of extermination of people with specific profiles, let's say, well, this one, we're looking for people, all people with a profile that suggests, in their own mind, because they make up these rules themselves, have a propensity to violence. And they started medicating these kids already based on these so-called phony, baloney genetic markers. It's just an extermination program.
Well, the fluoride
is doing that. It doesn't sound like that, you see? It sounds like they're trying to help. Doing the research that gathers information, and with this information, they can now identify children all over the country, let's say, with supposedly violent propensities. And even at the age of 5, to begin to medicate them. So this is what I'm saying. Be very careful. Never hand any kind of genetic material over to any individual or company. And these tend to be private companies, so they are subcontractors, or they would tend to be contractors with the government when the time comes, to give up material. You will have no right over the possession and control over your own genetic material. You don't know what they're doing with it. All we're told, and everybody's happy about it, is that, wow, we're going to discover something we've never really known. Where did we come from? Who are our people? What is our ancestry? And you think it is accidental that this is at the core of the appeal of the program? Everybody wants to know where they come from. And if you come from a group of people who had been enslaved, they could tell right now how many people have certain characteristics of particular tribes, or I don't like the word tribes, of particular peoples in Africa and elsewhere. They can tell. So it wouldn't be bizarre in the future where a governmental order is developed. We need to, because we want to purify, America racially. And that also includes separating people who are mixtures of African and indigenous people. We don't want that mix, because more than likely, if it should come to a fight, they would cooperate with each other against us. So we will seek out those characteristics that we want, and we will, when I say seek out the characteristics that we want to destroy, let's say, anybody with an ancestry, that goes all the way back to Dahomey. They could find you.
Okay. Well, they identified me as Fulani.
As what?
Fulani.
Yeah, but you don't know what that means. You don't know whether they know what that means.
Well, but this is African ancestry.
It's a one-sided thing. They just come up with a profile and say, yeah, this is what we found. You have no idea whether it's scientifically provable, whether it is correct, whether it is even real. They may be, you know, they're just like the Wizard of Oz. There's a guy manipulating things, and they have all different kinds of ways of manipulating information. This is not a scientific process, is what I'm saying. And it is not bound by any legal prescriptions, and not enough people have thought about it and challenged it. So you can't hold on to my genetic material. What was I thinking?
Yeah, but there are certain features that apply. Like, for instance, you know Italian person by their certain features. You know Ethiopians by their features. You know the Somalians by their features.
But that's
most
not
of the time
true.
You know the Kenyans just by their features.
No, I could show you Italians who are as black as you.
Well, because they're mixed.
They're Italian. Ever.
They're mixed. Hannibal cartilage.
They're Italian. That's the people who came from a particular region. You know, in the United States, for example, yes or no, this issue of race is so crazily handled. Anybody with a Muslim last name was white. And that prevailed for many decades. Anybody with a Hispanic last name was automatically white. You could be blacker than 5 past midnight. The government says you're white. They don't know what the hell they're doing. And they created things out of nowhere. I know many Italians who are dark-skinned, and this was part of the issue, within the Italian world and within the Mediterranean world. Do you have, quote, swarthy skin? That is, are you close in complexion to Hannibal?
Yep.
Yeah, so they make things up. They have no scientific basis for what they're doing. Mm-hmm. They make things up so as to control society. I'm going to tell somebody, there was a guy, a major case, as a matter of fact, I don't remember his name, but he was from Egypt. Look at him, he's black. He has been fighting
on YouTube
to reclassify himself as black. Right,
it's on YouTube.
And that's real.
It's on YouTube.
The government said, you are white. Why?
I've seen it on YouTube.
You're from Egypt, and you are white. There are no black people in Egypt. So he is actually going to court. He has been to court time and again to insist that he be racially reclassified and calling into question the so-called scientific basis on which he has been classified as a white man. So people don't know what they're doing. But they know what they're doing from the point of view of the ultimate goal, which is to very severely structure society in a particular way. There was a time when Chinese in the United States were white. The Japanese were white. There's a great book I would recommend to you called White by Law, written by Ian Haney Lopez. And he explains purely from a legal point of view the political decision around how people are classified racially. So I recommend this work to you. It's a fantastic book. But think again about the possible implications of how your genetic material can and will be used, that it would have nothing to do with your simple interest of trying to find, to get closer to your own identity.
Yes, because that has been a main interest for African American people, because we don't know exactly where.
That's why they did it. We know it. Thanks so much, Peter, for your call. David from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon, Eutrice.
Hi, how you doing, David?
I'm getting along well, thank you. I just want to reinforce the call out for the meeting when you're going to be at the Community Church of New York on the 11th of March at 1:30 p.m. If people want to know more about the Community Church, they can go to Google and put in Community Church of New York, and they'll find their things like their address, which is 40 East 35 Street, 35th Street in Manhattan, between Park and Madison Avenue, close to everything, close to the Grand Central Station, the Penn Station, the bus terminal, all the subways and buses, easy to get to in Midtown Manhattan, 40 East 35th Street. And if you want to know more, just go to your Google and put in Community Church of New York. This is a wonderful opportunity for people living especially in the area of New Jersey, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, and really throughout the world, because you have listeners from everywhere. It would be wonderful to see Harvey and other scholars that listen to your program come to New York on the 11th of March this year at 1:30 and see you. So it's going to be a wonderful day. I'm very much looking forward to that. So I just wanted to reinforce that, you'll be there at Community Church of New York, which is at 40 East 35th Street in Manhattan, and New York, New York. So I'm looking forward to seeing you that day. So that's basically what I have to say.
All right. Well, thank you very much. But before you go, David, in fact, you reached out to me as part of the membership of an international committee associated with the church. Tell us about
that. That's correct. Yes, and we're all looking forward to seeing you that day. You know, it's a wonderful opportunity for you to come up to New York and spend that time with us. It's a gift. Thank you so much. I know all the people in your, what I call a 600-level course or seminar every day that you carry on. This would be a wonderful opportunity to meet some of these people. And I'm looking forward to it very much.
That is what I'm looking forward to very much as well. Thank you, David, for your call today.
Thank you.
Fiona from Michigan, you're on the air.
Greetings, Utrice, and greetings to your audience. Can you hear me okay?
Thank you. Yes. It's a little low, the volume, but that's
okay. Is this better?
Yes.
Okay. I wanted to ask you again about, well, first of all, I thank you for being who you are, and I appreciate your brilliance. You make me think of
I
things.
Thank you, huh? Brilliance? Okay. I'll take it.
Okay. I wanted to talk about or ask you about your comments about the color purple in the context of movies that you were talking about earlier this week. And I wasn't absolutely clear, I don't think, what you said about that film, The Color Purple. Now, I'm interested in that because reading that book, The Color Purple, was pivotal in my journey through life. And I remember having a chance to meet Alice Walker once and thanking her for writing that book. And I believe her saying, she didn't say this to me, though, but the ancestors were instrumental in her writing that book, she felt. Now, I was hoping that you could talk again about The Color Purple, that film, and its impact.
Well, it's just my reaction. As I said, I grew up going to the movies quite a lot. My father owned a movie theater.
Mm-hmm.
And I am the only one in my family like this. I'm twisted like this. I'm into movies, but in a way that most people are not. I see things most people don't see about the movies. The movies will never give you a taste of real life, but they would come close, or they would try to get as close as possible in some cases to bring us back to a point of examining our collective lives and individually as well. Mm-hmm. The Color Purple was a watershed movie because it brought to life a sliver of life. But it was not history. It was a story being told. Mm-hmm. And it's okay to tell a story that has so many really disappointing and horrific aspects to it. So that the movie was a teaching tool. It was not just a movie. It gave us the impression that, you know, here is black life. And it's there huge on the screen for a particular purpose. It was the first time that the image of black people was so large on a screen. And that was a particular and deliberate calculation by Steven Spielberg, who I admire as a very gifted cinematographer. And he presented this movie, of course, in collaboration with the author and so forth, to present this story. But we didn't understand this simply to be a story. We were encouraged to believe this is black life. And therefore, the role of cinematographer becomes much larger than the role of cinematographer. The role of cinematographer was transformed into the role of teacher, into the role of cultural guardian, into the role of historian. And on a political level, we have to examine that because there are too many contradictions there. Should the community be, and this is a philosophical question, a political question, should someone so far outside of our community, having no real experience with it, even though the film is a translation of what a black author presented in a book, should we not have something to say about what we are seeing, what is being presented for an international audience? There's so many things that were devastatingly wrong with the movie if we are to interpret the movie in the context of our lives. The relationships between men and women were so brutal and one-sidedly so. Women were abused, had worse rights than working for white plantation owners, living with a black man. It endorsed the view that black people are not about very much. They're not concerned with their future. They're not. All the stories that we know that are also important, those stories were not there. We see in the end that Celie finds refuge in a lesbian relationship with a singer, a saloon singer who had hit bottom, was alcoholic, but still preferable as a choice in partner than a black man. I'm not saying this is a criticism in the sense that we understand regular criticism. I'm saying that these messages are encoded not only for an audience to accept without saying, hey, wait a minute. That is not the black life I know. All this, everything is in a concentrated area. Blacks are not engaged in meaningful work or meaningful life. And there's a degree of brutality that just was unrelenting. All right. At the same time, Spielberg, as a cinematographer, did a splendid job. Now, if the story were different, and if he, as a cinematographer, could have shaped different aspects of life to say, well, it isn't all this bad. A woman loses a child. You have incest. Celie is raped by her father. I mean, it just goes on and on and on about all the awful things. Now, for example, there are people in Africa who actually endorse, but it's not lesbian relationships in the sexual sense. They endorse marriage between or among women, and certainly about among men, but for a specific reason, but you never know that. That that was a critical element of survival in certain, among certain peoples. It is considered a crime, a social crime of great neglect, to have a woman come into the fullness of her years without having a way to support herself, without having the benefit of family. So their response has been to arrange marriages, but not in the sense that the European understands it. They arrange marriages to guarantee safety, that there's no homelessness. It has nothing to do with sex. People are free within certain of these societies to do whatever they want sexually. But this issue of women marrying women has an entirely different application. It is that you will have a place to live. You will have food to eat. You will have people who will care about you into your final days. And there's a big thing that is made about a marriage, such a marriage. It's been going on for centuries. It is not about a way to find love in the way people define it. It's about guaranteeing the wholeness of a community. And the one thing that I say is our first imperative, which is survival. That's how that is done. The entire village participates. The entire village approves. The entire village knows. And the entire village is happy that this woman finally is married. And therefore, she is not going to be battered by all these tribulations in life. She has the whole village as a family, and she has a particular person who might be a woman who will be taking care of her, and that's the marriage. See, so two entirely different definitions. Mm-hmm. But that is not within the consciousness even of the author. So when you see these kinds of things, you say, well, geez, it's a movie. No, it's not just a movie. It is social and cultural and political conditioning. And we have to see these as instruments of mass control. What do we think?
Wow.
Why is it necessary that every relationship has to be abusive and men come off looking like demons? Just to tell the story of Celie, who had had a rough time in life. You don't have to do that to destroy the institutions, which are admittedly battered, but they're there. And that's how we are still surviving. So Steven Spielberg made this great advance in cinematography by placing front and center for the world to see black faces as they've never seen them before. This was a great, great thing that he did, because the movie became very centered on black life. Unfortunately, along with that came a lot of baggage that we didn't need. But here's the thing I wanted to point out. Why movies are strategic tools to the power elite. Now, because a person made a movie, half of black folks weren't talking to the other half of black folks. Everybody was mad. But here's the thing. The Jewish community punished him greatly for making this movie. They saw it as a kind of betrayal. Why would he, Steven Spielberg, elect to make a movie, a grand movie, with all the beautiful cinematography and so forth, about black people, when his first priority as a Jew should have been to document the Jewish experience, as in the Holocaust? They punished him. He never won an award for The Color Purple, although it was clearly a superior film artistically. But he was on the outs. They cast him out. And in order for him to get back in, and he still isn't fully back in, he had to make a film, and it was a three-part film, I remember, Shoah. It was one of the longest films on record, because it actually was in parts, but it was meticulous in the documentation or the presentation about the Holocaust. Only then did he get some kind of reprieve, but he was banished from Hollywood because it was felt that he lost his way. He lost his sense of priority. And he devoted his time to telling a black story as opposed to telling his own people's story.
Okay.
Now, that's missed a lot, but I paid attention. Until Steven Spielberg made Shoah, he was on the outs in Hollywood. Nothing, he couldn't even make a commercial. So we have this dual issue to bear, and our dual issue is we always have to be guardians of the interpretation, even by people who are black. Misinterpretation or not understanding what movies really are about. They're about shaping people's lives and their thoughts and their opinions, and even of themselves. So movies are very political things. It's not about whether you're a great photographer or cinematographer or editor. No. It's about what is the story you're telling here? And how is it likely to shape mass opinion and even behavior? That was a message of Birth of a Nation, right? The story of the rise of the Klan, shown in the White House. The idea is to endorse and to excuse the violence, the just genocidal kind of violence. And they made it into a very nice little narrative. It's a nice little movie. Nice enough to show in the White House. So we have to get over this notion that it's only a movie. We're still in that time where we have to fight and assert our rights to call the shots on our culture, our politics, our lives. We should not allow people to mess around with that. We're not yet into the world of the paradise where all people are created equal and blah, 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 blah. We're still in the process of intellectual domination and slavery. And we're still grappling with white supremacy. Even when the actors are black, the directors are black, you can't trust the process. to recognize the existential duty to present a whole and holistic picture. So it's your fault you asked me the question. Thanks, Leona, for your call.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Okay. You're welcome. Bill from New Jersey, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Yatrice.
Hello?
Hello, I'm here.
Yes, good.
Good afternoon, Yatrice.
Hello.
Again, your comments on The Color Purple, spot on. I was a young man when that came out, and I remember black people were so flattered that this great Steven Spielberg would do a movie with black people, but did not take into account that everyone in the movie was a horrible person. The overarching message you would get from the movie is black people are terrible people, have all kinds of problems, and if you do eventually stand up for yourself, you'll just get abused. There's no point to any of it. That was the message I got from it, and I'm sure that was the message that was intended to be sent out by that movie. It was terrible. When you first talked about the Color Purple earlier in the week, you were saying what brought it up is you were saying that the success of Black Panther we've seen recently, most recently, the fervor over The Color Purple, where black people rush out and spend their money. And I would say there is a more recent example of the fervor over Black Panther, and that would be in the election of Barack Obama. Black people were so happy to have someone black to vote for, just like the Black Panther. Oh, we've got a black superhero. Barack Obama was the black superhero. And they rushed out in droves to vote for him, and that's how he got elected. And he did absolutely nothing, just like the movie will do absolutely nothing other than give away $400 million of purchasing power, like you said. We got just as much out of voting for Barack Obama as we're going to get out of the movie Black Panther, which is nothing. Nothing at all. And he was just as fake a superhero as the Black Panther.
It's true.
Just as fake.
But, you know, we still do have to, you know, be on point. You can't let your guard down just because it's a movie and everybody wants to. Everybody has such high hopes.
Absolutely not. You have to think it through.
No.
You have to think it through. And on another level, I even object to this whole thing of our first black superhero. Really? First of all, Marvel Comics had black superheroes 50 years ago. And this Black Panther is a recent thing. So they had black superheroes 50 years ago, quite a few. As I remember, I was a comic book reader, quite a few, but none of them were chosen. And also, Halle Berry has been a black superhero in two different movies, several movies. She was Storm in the X-Men and had her own movie, Catwoman. So there have been black superhero movies before. Why all of a sudden is this the first one? This isn't the first black superhero any more than Barack Obama is the first black president. As far as I know, there have been six other presidents that had non-white blood.
The hype is big, and
it's
connected
insane.
To money that even in the white world they've never seen. Don't forget, the movie industry is dying.
Yes.
And
yes, it is.
The only hope of a mass revival is what is happening now. The black folks are going to single-handedly resurrect the movie industry as a whole.
Thanks
so much for
your
call. We've come to the end of the program, I'm afraid, and we've run out of time. I thank you all for calling in with such incredibly detailed opinions. It means that you've given thought to what you say, and I think that that's the best representation of yourselves. You You're thinking people, and that's a great assurance. Stay tuned. Coming up, Dr. Jack Rasmus and Alternative Visions. And please, over the weekend, give yourself some time for yourself and people who you are connected to. Give some time to that kind of work, because we see what is in store, right? Fragmentation. We have to shore up our defenses. So thanks so much again, and keep March the 11th open, and we'll talk about it in the next couple of days. All right. Have yourselves a great weekend, and we'll see each other. Bye.